truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the fourth and final part of a panel discussion by four Canadian professors focusing on 9/11. Then I'll tell you about an event, a book, and the Bilderbergers. So first for the panel discussion. One of the professors, Graham McQueen, spoke in West Hartford at our March 2010 Remember Building 7 conference. The other three are Anthony Hall, John McMurtry, and Michael Kiefer. Graham and Michael were also involved in the Toronto hearings in September of 2011. So let's begin.
It's worth remembering that in occupied Western Europe during the Second World War, the Nazi term for the resistance to their occupation was terrorist. Nelson Mandela was labeled a terrorist by the apartheid regime of South Africa. Now, what has been happening since 9/11, what has been enabled by 9/11, is in part a deliberate reversion to pre-Enlightenment forms of justice and jurisprudence. I mean, think, for example, of the Fifth Amendment to the American Constitution, right? The amendment against self-incrimination. What's that there for? That amendment is there so that you cannot be forced by agents of the state into a confession, into self-incrimination. It is explicitly a response to the pre-Enlightenment forms of legal investigation, in which one of the first things you do is to torture someone. And the function of torture is very deliberately to put the state's language into the mouth of the accused, so that you are made to speak someone else's words. And the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is there as an obstruction to that kind of process. Now, in a bizarre manner, the jurisprudence of the War on Terror is a reversion to pre-Enlightenment Europe, one of the great, I think it's really an unequaled historical scandal, because other cultures didn't experience this same thing, was the Western European witch hunts of the 16th and 17th century. Don't think that witch hunting was something that happened in the medieval period. It wasn't. It didn't happen then. It happened, it began in the late 15th century. It developed into a major scourge around 1560 in the 16th century. And the really appalling, the horrifying, the mass witch hunts are a feature of the 17th century. They coincide in many parts of Europe with the horrendous effects of the 30 Years' War in Germany and elsewhere. Now, one feature of that structure was the dissemination by authorities within Western Europe of a mythology that said, we are under threat by immensely powerful demonic agents who have recruited all kinds of people into effectively sleeper cells, and we must act against them by abandoning all of the previously understood legal precautions that, you know, were built in a fairly inadequate way into the legal codes of the time, because what we are facing is what Latin jurists of the Renaissance called a crimen exceptum. This is a crime beyond the borders of any normal criminality, and therefore we have to respond to it by, as Dick Cheney would say, going to the dark side. In other words, we throw aside any restraint. Of course, the explicit, the obvious result of that kind of throwing aside of restraint was that you produced cascades of multiplying accusations and incrimination. You take one person, you torture him into confessing that all his neighbors are witches, and so on and so on and so on. Now, we are in the process of replicating those structures in this appalling reversion to a pre-Enlightenment mindset and a pre-Enlightenment set of practices in this fraudulent war on terror.
If you read the report of the 9/11 Commission, the crucial parts of that document, which determine who the criminals were mostly obtained under torture. and we have statistics on this. The footnotes have been studied in detail. You look at all this crucial information about who did what and which of the 19 terrorists did, and you look in the footnote, KSM, September 1st. That means Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was tortured, and his confession supposedly said this, this, and this, with no corroborating evidence, and we're not even allowed to see the document that he supposedly produced. The 9/11 Commission wasn't even allowed to meet with him or view the tapes or anything.
Or to meet with his torturers.
Right.
And then the tapes were destroyed.
So talk about the CIA. Talk about a parallel to the witch hunts.
Well, yeah. I'm going to give my parallel here. This is from the most one of the most famous documents of the Enlightenment, which is the American Declaration of Independence, issued on July the 4th, 1776. And I call attention to this often, but I don't see other people calling attention to it, so I'm just going to persist. So this is the text of the American Declaration of Independence, where we see these famous phrases about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then we get into an indictment against King George III. As students at the other end will have heard this, but who knows who's listening to this either now or at some other time. So this reference speaks to King George. King George is he. King George has excited domestic insurrections among us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. And that seems to me to be a perfect rendition of the idea that the merciless Indian savages are terrorists. They do violence in unpredictable ways. They inflict violence arbitrarily on civilians, on women, on children, on elders. So isn't it interesting to find that the United States is founded on principle that the people sitting on the land that is going to be the
example of the operation. Mm-hmm. Of projecting onto, in this case, the First Peoples, projecting onto them what the United States themselves is doing to them as their major crime. Mm-hmm. Because, in fact, they didn't do this. We don't see an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. I mean, I don't know of too many cases where that happens from the First Peoples, mm-hmm. but we know that that happened on a systematic basis of extermination to them. Mm-hmm. So they're being blamed for what their oppressors are doing to them as a justification for it. That operation is the one that I find most sort of mind-boggling, and that it is going on now for 200 years, and it still goes on. Like, I mean, just those the wording, mm-hmm. it applies really only to the occupying powers.
And, of course, the merciless Indian savages just happen to be sitting on the resources.
Yeah.
That the United States is being created to absorb. Mm-hmm. It wants to push beyond the British imperial restrictions to expansion into the interior and the privatization and transformation of the interior of the United States into capital, mm-hmm. into new capital.
Money sequence.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, yeah. I mean, it's the same thing like in Britain, like the members of the Conservative Party used to walk around wearing Hang Mandela t-shirts, you know? And they didn't care. But I mean, what it comes down to is what we're discussing is that terrorism is the warfare of the weak and powerless, and warfare is the terrorism of the strong and powerful. And if we think of it through that mindset, then yeah, I mean, like in Dr. Hall's book, he talks about Tecumseh. Well, Tecumseh would have been a terrorist against capitalism at that time. And I think of when Rosa Luxemburg said, you know, humanity had a choice between socialism or barbarism. And it seems like we're choosing the former rather than the latter in the current day. And, you know, when we put it in the Canadian context and look at the witch hunts of the modern day against halal meat or the hijab, or, you know, in Holland, they banned the burqa for 100 women who wore the full burqa. They demonized them and enshrined the law to say, well, no, there's something other. And it reminds me of in Nazi Germany, Fry Muller said, they came for the communists, I was not a communist, so I did nothing. They came for the Jews, I was not a Jew, so I did nothing. They came for the trade unionists, I was not a trade unionist, so I did nothing. And then they came for me. And, you know, if we think of it that way, that's why we have to stand in solidarity with Muslim students, Arab students, the new despised minority which is being induced, because it could be, who knows who will be the next ones, you know? It used to be the native people in South Africa, and then they emancipated themselves and so on. So that's why I think we're talking about in the Canadian context, well, yeah, when there is this war on the burqa or a war on the hijab or war on halal meat, or we're locking people up for terrorists, where by state terrorists, we have to illuminate this hypocrisy, otherwise nothing's going to ever be, you know, we won't drag ourselves back into post-enlightenment thought, will we? I mean,
this isn't a direct follow-up to that, I think, really lucid, splendidly lucid intervention. But one of the things that's at issue, and this goes back to the question that was raised a few minutes ago, of national sovereignty. Our government permits the agents of a foreign state to swan around on our soil fully armed and ready to use those weapons. Right? This has been formally permitted by the Conservative government. Now, it came to light, I think, on the Six Nations Reserve, Brantford, when the Six Nations police arrested some suspicious-looking people who were roaring around in an SUV, and they turned out to be BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, agents from the United States. What were they doing, fully armed, in this country? And furthermore, on Six Nations land, there's a double violation of sovereignty, but a violation of sovereignty clearly winked at and permitted by our own government. Now, that's a very supine kind of stance on the part of anything presuming to call itself a national government. Oh yes, we don't mind if your police agents move around through our population fully armed and, of course, ready to use those weapons. Moreover, we don't mind if we have some sort of emergency, and this is what our government now accepts, we don't mind Northern Command forces, in other words, American forces, intervening in our territory to deal with the situation. Now, that's a complete abdication of sovereignty.
I'd like to say something now, because I feel we're, although I agree with all this, going down a path of extreme negativity here. As we come toward the end of this, I'm trying to think of anything good that we might say, not in a Pollyanna sense, but perhaps that can give us some realistic hope. I'm talking about Canada, since that's the theme, and the media in Canada. I just wanted to say that I have been interviewed on the radio several times, but twice really well done in Canada. Usually it's by small radio stations, in my experience. You know, a little town of this, a little town of that. And also when I was in the United States in Montana, State Montana Radio did a great interview. And then, perhaps not a breakthrough, but an interesting thing that happened was when Michael and I were recently on TV Ontario, Steve Paikin's show, The Agenda. I went with Barry Zwicker to make the pitch that Steve Paikin should have us on the show, and he listened. And he said he would think about it and that he was interested. And you know what? He did it. I may not think the show was perfect. I may, you know, wish I'd said this instead of this, or that he had perhaps given us a little more time. It was quite rushed. But the fact is, I think he was fair. So I think that there are opportunities when it comes to 9/11 for us to talk about this issue, that we shouldn't give up. I mean, I tend to be pretty cynical, frankly, so that probably without the urging of other people, I wouldn't have gotten involved in any of those initiatives. But in retrospect, glad I did. So I think we should continue to press. And I think, as Michael said earlier, the tide is perhaps changing on this issue. It's going to, if our movement is successful, we will erode the taboo and we will sort of be able to eventually invade the halls of power. So I hope that perhaps we can have one or two hopeful comments and useful comments. Perhaps people can talk about things we should do as we move toward the end.
Yeah, we're summing up now.
If I can follow up from, I think that's a very welcome turn. Thank you, Graham. I think that people in the media do respond to intelligent pressures. If they write something hostile to 9/11 skepticism, and they get a torrent of abusive emails saying, you know, you're a CIA plant or you're a nincompoop or whatever, that's exactly what they expect, and that confirms their prejudices. If, on the other hand, what they get is instead a torrent of thoughtful, evidence-based, clearly expressed, and lucid responses, they scratch their heads. Now, there was a very interesting reaction on the part of the National Post's Jonathan Kay, who has described himself as one of this country's main cheerleaders for the war on terror, those are his own words, who, now incidentally, he wrote a very decent piece in, I think it was this past September, about the Omar Khadr case, in which he summed up the evidence and expressed a due sense of shock and dismay at the behavior of our government and said, do something. Trump says, do something, bring this kid home. And it was very interesting to see the reaction of the kind of howler monkey chorus that usually posts in response to his pieces on the National Post, because they were bewildered. Here was their cheerleader for the war on terror saying something they hadn't expected. Now, in late October, he did something similar. He'd written a piece trashing 9/11 inquirers and got, by his own account, a large number of carefully thought out responses. And he had the decency to admit in his October 27th column that in comparison to the people who'd written to him, he didn't know what he was talking about, which I thought was a very frank and open admission. And very interestingly, when I spoke at the University of Toronto last Friday, he was in the audience. He had come, I think, in part to, he was looking at the table of books that Global Outlook magazine had provided, and I think with some astonishment, he registered that there's a good deal of very solid-looking publication and research on the subject, and realized that he had to start getting up to steam. Now, that's perhaps one trivial example, but I think that within the constraints of the corporate structures that John has referred to, which are seeking to legitimize a certain pattern of largely hostile to life endeavors, there is a certain degree of openness, and I think that openness is expanding at the present moment in part because of the visible collapse of the money sequence system, right? It is visibly not working now. Global credit structures, global letters of credit have dried up. International trade is coming to a grinding halt as a consequence of this. And the confidence in its own legitimacy of the regulating structure has taken a very severe blow. So I think there's an important opening for thoughtful, skeptical, carefully worked out interventions, and strong interventions.
Final thoughts?
Well, I was just thinking of ringing my head where Michael's words about and hostile to life enterprises. I don't want to put it that loosely. It is any civil commons, any universally accessible life good is what is the unspoken enemy that is systematically gone after, whether it's in Iraq or whether it's inside Canada with proposal for a new social drug plan or whatever. It's life, social life infrastructures that are what is in fact attacked, whether it's by defunding or whether it's by war, is in fact, and it's at a preconscious level because it doesn't have a private priced exchange for profit in it. It is therefore unnecessary or wrong or wasteful, and it is attacked. So to me, the whole positive basic way of going at things is to fight for the universal life support system infrastructures of every kind, whether it's for stable climates and water supply that you can depend upon, or well-labeled foods, or a new reaching our social infrastructure into areas that it's most needed, income security, jobs that are in the public sector for pollution abatement equipment. All these are social life infrastructures that have been the enemy, the unofficial enemy that's been attacked at every level. And that's really where I would see the positive ground of support and grow up through all this stuff that's happening. Because you'll notice everywhere these crimes are going on, you'll notice underneath it all is a money sequence advance and a social life infrastructure, or indeed ecological life infrastructure, loss and despoliation every time. And that's what's wrong with it. And so I say build from the ground up. Now, what we've got inside Canada, just to go back up to the kind of manifest phenomena that we find with 9/11 denial, is that when a member of a putative or contending member for parliament suggested that 9/11 was foreseen, she was removed from the scene immediately by the cowardly act of the head of the Liberal Party, And I didn't see, I mean, I don't read, that's another thing, by the way, don't forget mass media. Anything that's got advertisements, corporate advertisements in it is not reliable information. But here was something that just happened in our election, to give you, in 9/11 even being raised as an issue, was just boom, oh, finished. And it seemed that there was really no public outcry about it. That would have seemed to me a positive time to act. On the other side of it is Harper, who I've seen publicly say that Canada's and the U.S. values, this is when Bush was here, are exactly the same. He said that publicly in the press conference. And so I think the witch hunt, in short, I guess, the witch hunt is much more widespread and pervasive and confrontable inside our everyday life. We're finding it really basically everywhere, whether it's a member of power, whether it's Harper, whether it's my own brother used to be attorney general. This normalization of an attack on legality and ultimately underneath it all, attack on any common life infrastructure is a world destructive disorder. And the struggle for these very attacked life infrastructures that we hold in common, which is basically everything of worth that we have, is where the positive action should really lean in.
So I'm going to conclude with a hearty expression of thanks to our host, Professor Kiefer, Michael Kiefer. And I must say that I do work in Southern Alberta, which is where the Stephen Harper government has its base. It all started in that part of the world. And the reality that there's a larger community of colleagues, a larger community of scholarship. I must say to the three of you, the fact that I can sit at this table with you and find some acceptance here causes me to feel less lonely, less exposed, more confirmed in the fact that what we're doing is in fact rising to, you know, the higher responsibilities of our academic mission, and isn't some kind of hooky or some kind of subversion, but is rather rising up to what universities should be about and through our work are about. I did mention that I think there's going to be some reckoning in the future with what didn't happen over these last 8 years in universities, Canadian universities, U.S. universities. So there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of minds to share information with, maybe to even open and maybe push back the darkness a little bit.
And that concludes the panel discussion by the four Canadian professors, Graham McQueen, John McMurtry, Anthony Hall, and Michael Kiefer. In this discussion, they mentioned the Canadian journalist Jonathan Kay in a rather positive light. But in 2011, Jonathan Kay went on to write the very unflattering book called Among the Truthers, in which he discusses conspiracies and the protocols of the Elders of Zion ad nauseum and gives ad hominem attacks on various 9/11 truthers, but never does he mention the large volume of scientific evidence gathered by the truth movement that contradicts the official story of 9/11, which, as you know, is also a conspiracy theory. But that's not the book I wanted to tell you about. That book is Classified Woman by Sibel Edmonds, which was just released in 2012. And here's what it says on the back of the book about her. In this startling new memoir, Sibel Edmonds, the most classified woman in U.S. history, takes us on a surreal journey that begins with a secretive FBI and down the dark halls of a feckless Congress to a stonewalling judiciary and finally to the national security whistleblowers movement she spearheaded. Having lived under Middle East dictatorships, Edmonds knows firsthand what can happen when government is allowed to operate in secret. Here is a sobering perspective that combines painful experience with a rallying cry for the public's right to know and to hold the lawbreakers accountable. With U.S. citizens increasingly stripped of their rights in a calibrated media blackout, Edmonds' story is a wake-up call for all Americans who willingly or unwillingly traded security in the wake of 9/11. I recommend the book, and again, it's called Classified Woman by Sibel Edmonds. And now for the event. Architect Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, is on a 30-city tour to promote the world premiere of his new movie, 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. He'll be stopping in West Hartford on Sunday, June 17th at 7 p.m. at the West Hartford Town Hall Auditorium at 50 South Main Street in West Hartford Center. To get tickets, you can go to 911expertsspeakout.org, or you can also get them at the door. There are currently 1,700 architects and engineers who have signed their petition demanding a new investigation into 9/11. I'd encourage you to check out their website, ae911truth.org. They have lots of good articles, evidence, the latest in 9/11 truth. And again, to get those tickets, you can go to the website 911expertsspeakout.org. And again, the date is Sunday, June 17th at 7 p.m. And now let's talk a little bit about the Bilderberg Conference that was in Chantilly, Virginia from May 31st to June 3rd. I'm going to read you a little bit from an article from Global Research that was posted on May 30th. And it says, for immediate release, Green Party candidate Diaferia demands that Bilderberg Conference be made public. On the eve of the annual meeting of the notorious Bilderberg Conference, Green Party congressional candidate Joseph Diaferia has issued a statement demanding that the 58-year-old conference's meetings, deliberations, and decisions be made public. The conference, founded in the Netherlands in 1954, is a yearly assemblage of political and business leaders from North America and Western Europe that meets clandestinely. Politicians and heads of state are also frequently in attendance. It has been reported by many independent journalists that major policy decisions, including which trade agreements will be enacted, which leaders will be deposed, and who the next presidents and prime ministers will be, are taken by the Bilderberg Conference. For example, the presidencies of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama are said to have been foreordained at the 1990 and 2008 conferences, respectively. This year's venue is said to be in Chantilly, Virginia, where the 2008 conference was held. When reminded of the conference's relatively recent admission of its existence, Diaferia commented, yes, they've allowed as how they exist, but that's all. They still insulate themselves from public oversight or any other democratizing process. In fact, they finally stipulated to their existence only because they could no longer conceal it. For decades, independent journalists have pursued the conference assiduously, and finally, David Rockefeller, I believe in his memoirs, had no choice but to acknowledge the conference's existence. But their discussions and confabulations are never made public. If you want to learn more about the Bilderberger meetings and who attended the conference this year, you can go to the website bilderbergmeetings.org. And just to give you an example of a few of the attendees, one was Keith Alexander, Commander U.S. Cyber Command, Director of the NSA. The CEO of TD Bank Group, Edmund Clark, was there. The Governor of Indiana, Mitchell Daniels Jr., was there. The Vice Chairman, Global Head of Growth Markets of Goldman Sachs and Company, Michael Evans, was there. Co-founder and Executive Chairman of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, was there. And that just gives you an example of a few of the people in attendance. And again, the website to go to is bilderbergmeetings.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.